I appreciate this opportunity to have a share in this study. It's been a blessing to me, and I hope all of it's been a blessing to you as well. I want to start with Acts, the 13th chapter, and read verses 20 and 21. And after that, he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. And afterward, they desired a king, and God gave unto them Saul the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. My lesson today, or study today, has to do with this reign of Saul, a son of Kish. This is a brief study of Israel's transition from their tribal confederacy to their monarchy. Very important time in the history of Israel. The tribal confederacy of Israel served the nation of Israel for between 300 and 450 years. Now, I've heard different figures given out in the study today, and I know why, because I couldn't settle on one either, so I've just enlarged that particular time. And anyway, at any rate, from the death of Joshua until the time of Samuel, was somewhere along in that particular time here. After his death, the people failed to do two things so far as leadership was concerned. When Joshua died, they did not choose a national leader like they had with Moses and Joshua. And another thing, they did not choose counselors to take the place of the elders of Joshua's council. Judges 2, verses 7 through 10. As a result of this, Judges 21 and verse 25 describe their dangerous situation. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own sight. In fact, as I believe it was Mike mentioned, in three other places, Judges 17 and 6, 18 and 1 and 19 and 1, this same information is given by the author of Judges. And each time this fact is used, it occurs in a bad situation. Another time in Judges 18, verse 7, the word magistrate is used in the place of king. There was no magistrate in the land that might put them to shame in anything. Now, since there was no one to stop them from doing shameful and sinful things, the Israelites found themselves forsaking God, in trouble with their enemies defeating them and placing them in bondage, Judges 2, verses 10 through 15. In reality, they had forsaken God and were being punished. And when their punishment became greater than they could bear, God would raise up a leader. Judges 2, verse 16, or the people would select one to deliver them from the hands of their enemies, as occurred in Judges 11, verses 5 through 6. These men were called judges. The word judges is used to describe these men as deliverers or as saviors, as was mentioned today, and not in the ordinary sense of one who hears and decides cases in legal court. Samuel, a prophet and a priest, was the last of these judges. I want to study Samuel's role in this transition. Now, Samuel had elevated the work of a judge to a much higher level than any of his predecessors. He was a judge. He served the people as the equivalent of a high priest, I suppose, and also was used by God as a prophet to the Israelites. His work was so extensive, and his power was so great, that the word king could aptly be applied to him, and some do so in their writings concerning Samuel. Under him, the 12 tribes were more united than at any time since Joshua. However, in his old age, he appointed his two sons as judges in Beersheba, 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 3. Though they had a godly father who had given them good examples in faithfulness to God and the people, his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. As a result of the corruption of Samuel's sons and outside pressure from Israel's enemies, especially the Ammonites and Philistines, chapter 9, verse 16, chapter 12, verse 12, the elders in Israel came to ask Samuel to give them a king in verse 5. They said, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Now, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel, as he did in times of trouble, prayed unto the Lord. Now, why did Samuel react this way? He was a prophet and surely knew the various places in the scriptures that had prophesied Israel would eventually have a king to rule over them. It was hinted at in Genesis 17 and 6 when God made a covenant with Abraham. He said, "And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee." Of course, more nations that had kings came out of the loins of Abraham than just Israel. But couldn't Israel be included in this covenant? She was, according to Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 and 15. "When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother." Now, could any statement be more clear about Israel having a king to rule over her in the future? Why could not Samuel accept this idea of appointing a king over the people of God as fulfillment of this instead of being displeased? And another thing, God seemed to have Saul selected as the king of Israel in his anger, according to Hosea, the 13th chapter, verses 9 through 11, where it says, "O Israel, thou hast destroyed thyself, but in me is thine help. I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities, and thy judges of whom thou saidst, Give me a king and princes. I gave thee a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath." By forsaking God and his ways, they had gotten themselves into the severe predicaments that finally caused them to cry out for a king. It seems that God and Samuel were displeased with their request for at least the following reasons. Number one, Samuel was being rejected as Israel's leader, though he had served them faithfully all of his life. And his pride must have caused him to feel this rejection keenly. Number two, the people were not wanting a king like God wanted. They wanted one like the nations around them had. And number three, this was just another example of their rejecting God's kingship over their lives and wanting to be like the people of the world. Same problem we have today. The same spirit had been manifested by the people when Gideon delivered them from the Midianites in Judges 8, verses 22 and 23. "Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also. For thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Now the problem in the days of Samuel was that of all the elders that had come to request the appointment of a king to rule over them, there was no Gideon among them that requested the Lord to rule over them. They must have a king like the nations around them. So God granted their request. And although God and Samuel both knew that the request was not the best for them, God instructed Samuel to hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them and show them the manner of the king that shall rule or reign over them. 1 Samuel 8 and 9. So, Samuel immediately began to attend to this commission God had given him. Though he had a heavy heart over their rejection of him, he must have had some delight in warning them what the kind of king they wanted would expect and exact of them. Like so many who want what they want to fulfill their own selfish desires, the elders of Israel forgot to look on the other side of the coin to see what was there. They knew what they wanted a king for. They had not thought about what the king would expect of them. And Samuel delivers to them the warnings in 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 18. James E. Smith, in his book, The Books of History, summarizes Samuel's warnings in this way. Number one, the king would require them conscription for military service. Number two, seizure of private property. Number two, the carvee, a kind of labor tax. Number four, impressment of persons into royal service. And number five, a heavy 10% taxation, verses 15 and 17. And added to these five was a final warning about their serving this king they were demanding. He would be so severe in their dealings with them that ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight their battles. God then authorized Samuel to make them a king. And when the elders heard that their request had been granted, Samuel sent them back to their cities. Now the elders were willing to let Samuel and God choose the king. Saul would eventually be chosen, and that he was God's choice is indicated in 1 Samuel 9, verse 17. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, behold, the man whom I spake to thee of, the same shall rule over my people. A lot of things happened before this point of time that I believe will be valuable for us to consider. Now, I have some 45 minutes, I think, to tell you about all of this. However, the Apostle Paul covered all this information in his sermon in the synagogue in Antioch in Pisidia in just a few seconds, and did it in this manner. And afterward, they desired a king, and God gave unto them Saul the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up David to be their king. Now, perhaps at this time of the day, when we're all tired and probably a little drowsy, you would be happy if I were as brief as Paul. However, I am required to give details that Paul did not consider necessary to state. And I would use each thought he gave about this matter merely as my outline. Now, the details of how Saul was chosen are found in 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10. It is very interesting and sometimes an amusing story how a man went out in search of his father's asses, failed in his search, but found much to his surprise a kingship. Kish, a Benjamite, had lost his asses. These were very valuable animals to the Jewish people. Pelabay's Bible Dictionary states, the most noble and honorable amongst the Jews were wont to be mounted on asses. With us, the ass is a symbol of stubbornness and stupidity, while in the East it is especially remarkable for its patience, gentleness, intelligence, meek submission, and great power of endurance. The ass was the animal of peace, as the horse was the animal of war. Hence the appropriateness of Christ in his triumphal entry riding on an ass. Even the humble and poor families had their own ass or asses. And while they were used as beasts of burdens and for other domestic purposes, they often became the family pet and were treated as such. They were a valuable part of a family's estate. And because of this, Kish sent his son Saul in search of the family asses that had become lost. In chapters 9, verses 3 through 5, the trail of Saul and the servant is followed. They went through 5 districts without finding the lost animals. When they came to the 5th district called the land of Zup, Saul decided to go back home, thinking that his father might consider them to be lost also. In verse 6, Saul's servant said, "Behold now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he saith cometh surely to pass. Now let us go thither. Peradventure he can show us our way that we should go." Samuel stayed in the city of Ramah. This was a high place because an altar was there on which Samuel could offer sacrifices. This city was not quite 20 miles from where Saul's home was. He did not seem to know much about Samuel, which might cast some light on Saul's spiritual development and interest. His servant did know about the man of God being in the city, but neither of them knew where to find him. Saul was hesitant to go to see the prophet Samuel because he seemed to have no gift he thought suitable to give the seer. It seems to have been the custom for the people to give the seers a gift when they came seeking information from him. Samuel did not seem really interested in accumulating wealth. He certainly was not like his sons who turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Nor was he like the leaders in Israel described in Micah 3 verse 11, "The heads thereof judge for reward, and the priests thereof teach for hire, and the prophets thereof divine for money." In fact, in Samuel's address to Israel, he could boldly challenge them about his impeccability in his dealings with them in chapter 12, verse 3. "Behold, here I am, witness against me before the Lord and before the anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose ass have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind my eyes therewith? And I will restore it to you." No one could bring a charge against Samuel in such matters. Why then did Saul desire to take this prophet a gift? Well, it was the custom of that time and in that part of the world that when one approached the superior, he always took him a gift of some sort. And of course, it has always been God's plan that those who minister in spiritual affairs should reap of the temporal blessings of those they serve. Galatians 6, verses 6 through 8. So Saul thought it best to bring along a gift for the man of God. However, he did not have any food left, for their provisions were gone. We do not know whether Saul had any money with him. He may or he may not have. He does not mention the money if he did have it. It is strange, though, that his father's servant would have money and he did not. I'm going to put Saul in a bad light at this point. Some people like a cheap religion. They like the benefits of religion, but they are perfectly willing to let somebody else pay for it. Let us look at their conversation about this matter, and you can almost feel this attitude in Saul in chapter 9, verse 8, and also verse 10. "And the servant answered Saul again and said, Behold, I have here at hand the 4th part of a shekel of silver. That will I give to this man of God to tell us our way. Then said Saul to his servant, Well said, that's good, come on, let us go. So they went into the city where the man of God was." They didn't know where to find Samuel when they drew near Ramah. they found out from some young maidens that Samuel was indeed there, and a sacrifice was to be made that day, and they were there at the right time of day. Everything was working out so well that when they entered the city, there was Samuel coming toward them. However, Saul did not recognize him. Samuel even needed help from God in order to know that Saul was the man who would rule over Israel as king. Verse 17 states what happened. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, "Behold, the man whom I spake to thee of, this same shall rule over my people." All of this was happening as Saul entered into the city, probably through one of its gates. Since Saul did not recognize Samuel as the seer for him, for whom he was now searching, he asked Samuel where the seer's house was. And I think it will do us good to pause here and consider Samuel's appearance and his conduct. Though he was the greatest man in Israel at that time, serving as their prophet, their priest, and leader, he must have looked like an ordinary man. I think if one of us today would meet the Pope as we entered a city, we would probably recognize him immediately for several different reasons. Because of his dress, because of the great following he would have, along with all of the promotion that would have preceded him. Well, Samuel, the greatest man in Israel, was on his way to the high place to offer sacrifice and have a feast. Yet he was not recognizable to a stranger as anyone of importance, much less as the greatest man in Israel. Samuel knew that Saul was seeking him and not his house, so he answered, beginning with verse 19, "I am the seer. Go up before me into the high place, for ye shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let thee go, and will tell thee all that is in thine heart. And as for thine asses, they were lost 3 days ago. set not thy mind on them, for they are found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on thee and on all thy father's house?" Now, Saul's mind must have been put at ease when this information about the lost asses was given. They had already been found. And when Samuel informed him that he fit all the qualifications of the king all of Israel was now desiring, Saul had something new to worry about. One minute he was searching for asses, the next minute he was informed that he was to be the king. His humility on hearing this was profound. Matthew Henry, in his commentary on the context, observes that in Genesis 44 and 20, Benjamin was called a little one. That was characteristic of the tribe so far as the tribe's number was concerned. This small tribe of Benjamin was greatly diminished by the war of Gibeah that we've heard about. Saul states that he was not only a Benjamite, his family was the least family in the tribe. Verse 21. If Saul could have kept this spirit, he would have made a great king that would have pleased God and the people as well. He could not understand why Samuel was saying these things to him. Now, at the feast, Saul and his servant were placed in the chiefest place of all that were invited. Saul received a special cut of the meat that Samuel had already had the cook set aside just for this purpose. It is thought that this piece of meat was the right shoulder that God had designated as the portion of the sacrifice that belonged to the priest, according to Leviticus, the 7th chapter, verses 32 and 34. If so, Samuel had reserved his portion to give to Saul, perhaps indicating his willingness to be supplanted by Saul. At any rate, those noble persons who were bidden to come to this feast and who would ordinarily get to sit in the best seats saw Saul and his servant not only getting the best seats, but also receiving the best portion of food. Did they sense that something big was about to happen? Well, after the feast, Samuel and Saul communed upon the top of the house. We're not told what they talked about, but surely the seer must have told Saul about the desire of Israel and that God had selected him to be the first king of Israel. Then Samuel said to him, "Up, that I may send thee away." Saul arose, and they went out, both of them, he and Samuel, abroad. As they neared the outskirts of the city, Samuel instructed Saul to send his servant on ahead. Saul was to stay with Samuel to hear God's word. Then Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, "Is it not because the Lord hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance?" Thus, in a simple private ceremony, Samuel anoints Saul to be Israel's first king. In this act, though, are some great implications. The oil poured on him signified God had chosen him to be captain, which meant ruler or prince, over Israel. He was now set aside for that purpose. The kiss indicated to Saul that Samuel would relinquish his position as ruler over the people and that he himself accepted his appointment. We need to learn that lesson well today. Now remember, Samuel felt the people rejecting him and their desire for a king. The king was chosen, and the prophet with this kiss says, "I too accept." After this private coronation of sorts, Samuel told Saul of three signs that he would see on his way home. The first would be two men Saul would see at a particular place that would tell him his father's asses had been found and his father was now sorrowing after him. The second sign involved three men that would have three goats, three loaves of bread, and a bottle of wine. These three men would greet Saul and give him two loaves of bread. The third and final sign had Saul meeting a company of prophets who would be prophesying. At that time, God would turn Saul into another man by having his spirit come upon him. In chapter 10, verses 7 and 9, Samuel said, "And let it be, when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serves thee. For God is with thee, and God gave him another heart." All these signs came to pass that day. Now the third sign gives us some things to think about. Saul began prophesying with a company of prophets. This indicated that the Spirit of God had come upon him, and this would be considered proof that God had chosen and accepted Saul as the king and was with him. Questions were asked by the people in verses 10 and 12 when they saw him prophesying with the prophets. "What is this that has come unto the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And one of the same place answered and said, "But who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Now the father of the prophets was probably Samuel. It seems to be used in the sense of instructor, although according to Clark's commentary, the Septuagint adds the words, "Is it not Kish?" when he said, "But who is their father? Is it not Kish?" This was an affirmation that Samuel was the one responsible for Saul being counted among the prophets. The proverb that came from the event, "Is Saul among the prophets?" perhaps tells us something of Saul's past reputation. If the Hebrew people applied the proverb to a man that was bad but turned good, or to a bad man seen in association with good men, then it leads us to believe that Saul had not been the best he could have been. His association had certainly not been among the prophets before this time, and he had not been seen singing and praying and teaching as he was doing now. But now he is a man with a new heart and new interest, and we might add a new profession, although by his words and actions you would not have known it even if you had been one of his near relatives, such as the one who asked him about these matters. Saul had been selected and anointed privately. But now it was time to make this known publicly. 1 Samuel, the 10th chapter, verses 17 through 27. Shortly after these events, Samuel gathered the people of Israel to a town called Mizpah, not too many miles from the city of Jerusalem. There he reminded them of what God had done for his people and that they had rejected God by requesting a king like the nations around them had. The choice of the king was to be by lots that God was controlling. The people were to pass by tribes. Out of the 12 tribes, Benjamin was chosen. Then the families of Benjamin passed by, and the family of Matri was chosen. Saul was a member of this Matri clan, and he was next chosen. However, Saul was still so timid and meek that he had hidden himself and could not be found. They had to ask the Lord where he was, and they were directed to look among the stuff. Other translations call this stuff baggage or equipment that probably belonged to some of the great number of people that had assembled there on that occasion. In chapter 10, verse 24, the simple ceremony and acceptance of Saul is concisely stated. And Samuel said to all the people, "See ye to him whom the Lord hath chosen, that there is none like him among all the people." And all the people shouted and said, "God save the king." Now I must here insert a statement from Clark's commentary concerning the phrase the people shouted, namely, "God save the king." He said there is no such word here, no, nor in the whole Bible, nor is it countenanced by any of the versions. The translations I looked in all rendered this, "Long live the king," instead of "God save the king." This constituted their acceptance of Saul as king so far as the record shows. There was no public anointing of Saul at this time. The anointing would come later. Samuel then told them the manner of the kingdom, wrote it in a book, and stored it before the Lord. Every man then went to his own house. Saul also went to his home in Gibeah, along with a band of men that the Lord had also touched. There was another group called the children of Belial, who despised Saul and rejected him as their deliverer. They brought him no presents. Saul, however, does not immediately deal with them at this time. He keeps silent about the matter, but it would be brought up again in the future. Samuel had told the people, "See ye him whom the Lord hath chosen." Perhaps we ought also to take a look at this man who was to reign as the first king of Israel. Saul exactly fit the description of a king like the nations had. According to chapter 9, verse 2, a Benjamite by the name of Kish had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and goodly, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. Now, instead of goodly and goodlier, other translations has handsome. Since he was a choice young man and was so tall, he would be a king that the people would easily accept. They cared not if he were head and shoulders above the others in spirituality. They were not concerned if he had a beautiful inner man. Their concern was his physical strength and beauty. This, they thought, qualified him to lead them against their enemies. There seems to have been a constant struggle between the tribes of Judah and Ephraim about who was the most powerful and who should rule the people. A king from the tribe of Benjamin would be an ideal choice since it was one of the smallest tribes and was situated between the borders of the two tribes wanting the rulership. Saul described himself in this manner in chapter 9, verse 21. "Am not I a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Wherefore then speakest thou of me?" This attitude is what caused Samuel to say the following words to Saul after he had disobeyed God regarding the Amalekites in chapter 15, verse 17. "When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel? and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel. At that time, Saul had lost the very characteristic that caused God and Samuel to choose him to be king over Israel. These observations are about all the important things we really know about Saul, though it tells about his family in other verses. Saul had returned to his own home and had taken up the menial chores of agriculture that most folks were engaged in at that time. He had no kingly palace to live in. He still had to go into the fields and bring the family's herd back to safety or back from work. As far as we can tell, he did not look nor act like a king. But all of that was about to change. An old oppressor of Israel, the Ammonites, descended from the younger daughter of Lot, had a king named Nahash, who took his army westward and besieged the city of Jabesh-Gilead. The city was the area assigned to the eastern half of land given to Manasseh's descendants. The citizens were agreeable to his ruling over them and their serving him. Nahash would have none of that. He would only make a covenant with them if they would permit him to thrust out their right eyes. This act was designed to bring disgrace upon all Israel. The elders pleaded for 7 more days so they could go to all the borders of Israel to find a man that would save them. Nahash, evidently believing that Israel was still weak in great disarray and without any effective national leader, granted them the 7 extra days. And besides, what could the citizens of this city do in 7 days? Could they really go to all Israel requesting help and getting it here in such short time? In chapter 11, verse 4, we are told that the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul. Here was their king. We wanted a king for such a time as this. Now let us see if he can help us. So when the people of Gibeah heard the terrible news, they began to weep. What aileth the people that they weep? And upon hearing the reason for all this sorrow, Saul immediately began to show in verse 6 that he deserved to be appointed the king of Israel as a deliverer. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard these tidings, and his anger was greatly kindled. And he took a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, "Whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen." And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. Could the sounding of a trumpet been more effective than Saul's actions? Probably not. Here was a message delivered in such manner the people could understand it. 330,000 men responded to this call. And as a result of this great show of soldiers, the following message was sent back to Jabesh-Gilead, and they even assisted Saul and his army with a deceptive message of their own to Nahash. And they said unto the messengers that came, "Thus shall you say unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun be hot, ye shall have help." And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh. They were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will come out unto you, and ye shall do with us all that seemeth good unto you." Nahash must have slept peacefully that night, believing that victory was in his hands. Somehow Saul and his army came in the midst of Nahash's army in the morning watch and killed the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Saul's victory was so complete, the surviving Ammonites were scattered so that there were not 2 of them found together. Saul must have been highly elated over this victory. 400 women from this city had been provided to the men of Benjamin for wives after the number of women among the Benjamites had been so depleted by the Civil War. From these women, Saul had probably descended. Now he had helped them. Saul depended on God during this battle against the Ammonites. In chapter 11, verse 7, he attached Samuel's name to his call to arms. Saul was still little in his own sight. But what would this great victory do to him? Now, the people said unto Samuel, "Who is he that said, 'Saul shall reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death.'" And Saul said, "There shall not a man be put to death this day For today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. Saul had now so impressed the people that Samuel decided it was time to make Saul king before the Lord in a public way. Now, all the people went to Gilgal, and they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. And there they sacrificed sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Now, it seems that Samuel closed out this great meeting with a blistering sermon. If you want to read that, I think that's recorded in chapter 12. Now, this is where he told them that he had not defrauded them in any way. And he goes on to tell them how that now that you have a king, and as long as you and the king obey God and keep his commandments, things will go well with you. If you or your king rebel against God and his commandments, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. The next three verses record a miracle that was used to confirm the words of Samuel as coming from God. It was the time of the year for them to harvest their wheat, which according to Clark's commentary would be the latter part of June or the first part of July. Some authorities have it a little earlier than that. But at any rate, rain did not occur at that time, and it came that day. And it scared the people so that they confessed their sins and asked Samuel to pray for them. And as part of his priestly and prophetic office, he was required to do that. All of this is recorded in verses 19 through 25. Samuel's answer was, "Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. But if ye shall still do wickedly, ye shall be consumed, both ye and your king." So with this promise and warning, Samuel closed his address. King Saul and the people now well knew the path they were to walk in order to maintain the correct relationship with God and receive his blessings. Now, Saul's 40-year reign was in its infancy at this time. And he begins to show great courage against the Philistines. With 3,000 soldiers, 2,000 of them under his direct command and 1,000 under the command of Jonathan, his son, the Philistines had encroached deeply into Israel territory, and a garrison of them encamped at Geba. Jonathan, Saul's son, was a man of faith. And while Saul was a man that was fearful in the face of such a large force of the Philistines, to make a long story short, Jonathan and his armor bearer went into the camp of the Philistines, and the Philistines, thinking that they had been invaded, all began to retreat and destroy themselves, and Jonathan achieved a great victory that day. Now, Saul had made a vash row, a vow about this, and that was something that he had finally helped to bring about his disfavor in the eyes of the people, because Saul said as long as the Philistines were fleeing, no man should eat. Jonathan did eat some honey he found in the field, and was almost brought to the point of death by his own father, but the people saved him. Now in chapter 15, Saul again showed his rebellious spirit. The Lord remembered what the Amalekites had done to the Israelites when they came out of Egypt toward the promised land. He instructed Samuel to tell Saul, "Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." He gathered a great army together and thoroughly defeated the Amalekites. In his rebellion, he and the people spared King Agag and the best of the animals. Although Saul told Samuel, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, I have performed the commandments of the Lord." Now he had not obeyed God, and this caused him to say to Samuel, "It repenteth me that I have to set up Saul to be king, for he turned back from following me and hath not performed my commandments, and it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto the Lord all night. Samuel then taught Saul, the people of that time, and us today, an important lesson. Saul offered an excuse for his and the people's actions, that they had saved the good animals to sacrifice unto the Lord in Gilgal. Samuel answered to this was, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Saul did not recognize this truth and certainly did not obey it. Samuel informed him that God had rejected him from being king. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught hold of the prophet's clothing and it tore. This is described in chapter 15, verses 27 through 28. And as Samuel turned about to go away, he laid hold upon the skirt of his mantle, and it rent. And Samuel said unto him, the Lord hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou. Saul confessed he had sinned and desired Samuel to be with him that he might worship God. Samuel required Saul to bring him King Agag. Samuel then proceeded to hew Agag into pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. After this event, Samuel did not come to see Saul anymore until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord repented that he had made Saul king over Israel. Now Saul's kingship began to decline in about the third year of his reign, when he offered a sacrifice that only Samuel or a priest had the right to offer. He bravely fought the enemies of God's people and delivered the Israelites out of their hands during the next 14 years. It was about 1079 B.C. when he disobeyed God regarding the Amalekites in the 15th chapter. Chapter 16 begins about 1063 B.C. Samuel has been mourning for Saul now for about 16 years. Saul was still serving as king, though he had been rejected by God as their ruler. One day God said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil and go. I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemites, for I have provided me a king among his sons. We should notice the contrast in this verse and the one where the elders requested Samuel to appoint a king over them. They had told Samuel in chapter 8, verse 5, make us a king. But now God told the prophet, I have provided me a king. This is one of the great distinctions between Saul's kingship and the kingship of David. And that took place in the next few verses of that chapter and the rest of the chapters up to chapter 18 and 19. And David's kingship began to ascend while Saul's really went downhill because God had rejected him. I'm going to just go ahead and stop right there.